A lot of science goes into warfare on our planet. We're constantly looking for weapons that will take out their guys and not hurt our guys. But there's a whole realm of science and military matters aside from the weapons, because the weapons are still largely carried by people, and keeping people as safe as possible while fighting a war is an ongoing quest. We get everything from uniform fabrics to diarrhea remedies in a book called Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. It is the work of Mary Roach. She's a prolific author who's given us best-selling books about dead people, the afterlife, sex, in a strictly scientific sense, and traveling to Mars, to name a few. She lives just down the road in Oakland, the California version. Mary Roach, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you so much.
Good to have you here. Given the fun you clearly have with your subjects, it's no surprise that you start this book with the chicken gun. What is the chicken gun?
The chicken gun is kind of what it sounds like. It's a heavy artillery piece for that fires chickens, specifically supermarket, defrosted supermarket chickens, no live chickens. And the chickens are fired at pieces of jets, like the canopy, the part that goes over the pilot. So in the case of bird strike, as they say in the military and aviation industries, the plane won't be damaged or brought down. So which is a huge problem, a tremendous number of bird strikes. And so the chicken gun was a way, and the chickens, you know, you want something you can standardize for testing. So a supermarket chicken is sort of a worst case scenario. It's certainly heavier and denser than some of the birds, you know, like a duck or that might hit a plane, but it serves the purpose. So that's what the chicken gun is.
I'm surprised to see there in that same section though that even some of the smaller birds like starlings can act like smaller bullets, but bullets just the same.
Yes, and it happens enough that somebody saw fit to coin a term, the feathered bullet phenomenon. there is not a corollary gun for starlings, so I guess the hope is that if it withstands a chicken, it will withstand a starling. But yeah, that is a separate problem. That sort of it's small enough to kind of pierce it like a bullet rather than shattering like a larger bird, like a turkey vulture might do.
So here we really get to the nub of what the book is about. I mean, the things that average folks do not think could make a huge difference on the battlefield, whether it's land, sea, or air, actually can. Stuff that that really doesn't involve necessarily the enemy, but just the conditions in which you're fighting.
Yeah, that's right. There's just all manner of disciplines that enter into keeping men and women safe and alive. And for example, this was new to me. I didn't know that there was a whole discipline of military entomology. And, you know, you would think, well, what is that about? And the more obvious take is that, repelling insects that cause disease, like sand flies and mosquitoes. And so that's part of what they do. And insects were up through this century. I mean, in previous centuries, flies in particular caused far more deaths than bullets and bombs. A ratio, and some, like in the Mexican-American War, 7-1 was the ratio of death by disease, mostly dysentery. Because what would happen, 7-1, the one being combat injuries, and what would happen, you have these field camps, and you've got open field pit latrines, and you've got sometimes decomposing bodies nearby. So these are magnets for flies. Plus the mess tent, where the people would eat, it wasn't screened. It's kind of out in the open, so the flies would land on the material in the latrines, and the pathogens would get on their feet. They'd land on the food. The food is sitting out unrefrigerated because, you know, we're out in a field somewhere. And the bacteria or whatever the pathogen is would multiply to exponentially to levels where everyone would come down with, and, you know, things like typhoid fever that would kill you. So flies, and in World War II, there were in some of the North African battles, they had fly control units, they had sanitation officers, there were even death quotas where each soldier was required to kill, I think it was 50 flies a day.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, and there are posters that you would see with a fly with a bayonet stuck in its belly saying, "This is the enemy." And it really was, because it was the fly was doing a very good job of killing soldiers. It was, of course, nowadays there are the mess halls, the dining facilities can be completely sealed because we have air conditioning. So there's a separation of latrine and kitchen, thankfully.
All right. So as long as we have upped the squeamish quotient already, we might as well continue along along the fly line.
Sorry.
Get into what's going to happen in the course of this topic. But so as long as we're still talking flies, let's move on to maggots and how they've actually been useful for wound repair, if people can believe that.
Yeah, this was something that was noticed in World War I by there was a surgeon named William Baer. And in France, there were a couple of soldiers that came in who'd been lying out in the bush for, like, I think he said 7 days, and their wounds had become infested, and there were maggots in the wounds. And, of course, you know, the immediate response was to clean out the wounds to get those things out of there. And he noticed that the tissue in the wounds underneath was pink and healthy, and there was no infection, there was no gangrene. And he began to wonder if the maggots were, in fact, helping. Because what the maggots were doing, maggots eat dead tissue selectively. That's their preferred menu option, is dead tissue. They leave the live stuff alone. So they are performing a kind of natural debridement, which is what it's important for, to get rid of the dead stuff to foster healing and new tissue to grow in. And so, and that is typically done surgically, and you know, if you have an IED injury, but maggots actually do a very good job of it, and they also they fight infection at the same time, and they are used today. There's a company called Medical Maggots, and there's a Medicare reimbursement code. The FDA has approved the maggot as a medical device, and they are used mostly in diabetic populations. They get these ulcers on the feet, and so anyway, the maggots are very helpful there.
Well, you know, I'd known about some of this before, but the fact that there's actually FDA approval for their use was the part that surprised me. But so there you go, the stamp of approval for the use of maggots. But hey, what works is what works, which is what this book is largely about. It is called Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. We tend to focus away from the ballistics and on all the other things that can help keep people alive on the battlefield. Mary Roach is the author and our guest. We'll come back and talk more with her and take phone calls and emails from you when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Mary Roach, who writes about science matters over the course of several books. Her latest book is about military matters and ways to help keep people ready for the battlefield and as safe as possible, aside from their weaponry. The book is called Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the subject matter. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's talk about your approach in general, Mary. Your books are about somewhat offbeat subjects, dead people, the afterlife, the science of sex, traveling to Mars. But as you point out, you're not the person with the spotlight, you're the goober with the flashlight. So where does your focus tend to fall?
Well, I like to cover the things that fall through the cracks, the things that are overlooked, and frequently they're kind of not necessarily taboo, but things that people might look away from or they're a little uncomfortable, and not because I have any real need to be gross, but what I like about things like maggots or diarrhea, which are two topics in the book, I think that because people often turn away, they don't realize how interesting these topics are, and in some cases how important. In both cases, you know, with maggots and diarrhea, they are matters of life and death sometimes, and that's interesting. So I'm taking people away from ew to, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, and you've done a good job with that, too. And one of the things you realize not far into the book is that there's a big chunk of the military-industrial complex devoted to to testing things that soldiers, sailors, airmen will use that doesn't involve the ballistic stuff. I mean, how big a complex is this?
Oh, it's enormous. There are whole labs that I had no idea. For example, there's the Naval Submarine Medical Research Laboratory up in Groton, Connecticut, which is where they are studying all kinds of things from sleep deprivation on submarines to, the air on board a sub to how can you, methods of escaping from a sunken submarine. So there's surgical labs, there are medical entomology units, there's bioengineering. So I don't have a dollar amount for how large it is, but it's surprisingly varied in its scope. And for someone like me who loves to poke around in unusual labs, it was kind of a nerd's holiday.
No doubt. Did you get refused in any of the requests you made to visit some of these places?
Yes, if the facility was classified, there was no way for me to gain access. And some of the things that were classified, I wouldn't have expected, like the camouflage laboratory at Natick Labs.
Huh.
That was the one place there, or the one place that I'm aware of, that I wasn't allowed to go. And also, obvious place, things like, my editor was keen to have me cover special operations and Navy SEALs things because, the public is very curious about that
right.
stuff. And so she thought maybe I could tag along on a mission, which is just hilarious. And I thought, and I so want to please my editor that I actually called up the Special Operations Command, the Public Affairs Office. And I thought maybe, because they have weather guys. And I thought, well, that's fairly innocuous. I could just tag along with the guy who, because weather is one of those things nobody thinks about it, but it can make or break a mission. And
sure.
I thought, well, that's fascinating. So I asked if I could go, profile the weather guy and go out on a mission. And the answer was obviously no. And I even said, but I'll only talk about the weather. I won't listen to anything else. I'll cover my ears when they talk about anything else. I'll only write and talk about the weather. that didn't work.
All right. Mary Roach is our guest in the exchange. Her book is Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. You mentioned not getting into one of the labs at Natick, Massachusetts, but you did get into some of the others. Tell us about the flame goddess of Natick.
Oh, yes. Margaret Auerbach is she's a textile technologist, a scientist who investigates textiles, whether it's a thread or a whole fabric, that are flame resistant. In other words, it's going to resist bursting into flame, which is obviously very important when you're around IEDs and explosions and burning things. And so she has a number of kind of amazing pieces of equipment. There's a laser, which is labeled Big Scary Laser on it, and you can, with a big red button that you push. And what she can do with that is the laser can kind of be a miniaturized version of an IED. They can calibrate it so that they've got a little piece of fabric, and they aim the laser at it, and it will tell you how much heat passes through the fabric. And so that will give you a sense of, will the person wearing this fabric be prevented from getting a burn? They also have to look at, does the chemical that you're, or whatever the treatment is that's making it flame resistant, are those chemicals, when they burn, harmful? Because you don't want to be kept from burning only to perish from inhaling noxious fumes. So they have to test that as well. She has they have a lab with a mannequin that kind of walks through a flame. I mean, they've got a flame going, and then this mannequin kind of moves through it. They can test, to put it into sort of a realistic scenario, and so flame resistance is what they're looking at there. And it's complicated, It's like the for example, she showed me a piece of camouflage print, and she showed how the dark areas responded differently than the light areas, because dark absorbs more of the energy than the light. The light portions would reflect some of it, and so there was all kinds of just the things you would never really think about day to day. But that's her area.
I love the washing machine, too, with the steel balls in it that just pounds the bejesus out of the clothing to simulate multiple washes. So they really have to figure out whether the coating's going to stay on and that sort of thing. Is there, Mary, an unattainable gold standard for military clothing, some point they want to reach? And if so, what would be the features of that clothing?
Oh, they would love to have an outfit that is, flame resistant, that repels chemicals. In other words, everything rolls right off in the case of a chemical attack, that repels mosquitoes, that is breathable and comfortable, because a lot of the flame resistant fabrics are kind of clammy to wear, and in a hot environment that's not going to work. So, breathable and something you can print camouflage on, which sometimes that's problematic too. So, as a basic uniform, we're not talking specialty gear, but for a basic uniform, that would be ideal. The difficulty is that all of these different treatments have to work well together. The chemicals can't sort of cancel each other out, or
prove toxic to the person.
Yeah, exactly.
Wearing them. Yeah.
Beyond
fabric choices alone, though, it, there's some things that you point out, like zippers, snaps, Velcro, not good things to have if you're a sniper.
Yeah, that's right, because if you think about it, snipers are often lying on their belly, so it's not to be seen. They're lying in position on their belly, and they may stay there for hours. So if you're lying on buttons or zippers, that becomes uncomfortable. Also, a zipper, if you're lying in dirt, debris, that gets into the teeth of the zipper, and soon it doesn't work. So when I was at Natick, the design studio, the designer was showing me a top for the sniper base suit, and it had a side closure on it for that reason. And I looked at it, I just thought, wow, that's very sleek and fashion forward. She said, well, it's actually practical. And I had said, well, what about Velcro? Why don't you close? Because that's flat. That wouldn't be as uncomfortable. And she said, no, but it's noisy. You open Velcro and it goes. So. A quieter Velcro is something that's on the wish list at the Army. Velcro is the brand name. They call it, I think, Hook and Loop.
Hook and Loop, that's right, yeah, right.
Yeah, Hook and Loop, a quieter Hook and Loop. They would love to have that because that is, if you're trying to stay hidden, if stealth is your agenda, then Velcro is not your friend.
No, you don't want to go behind some tree when you're hiding. Yeah, we're talking about military science and how it applies to ways other than just the ballistics and trying to keep people alive on the battlefield, whether it's land, air, or sea. Mary Roach is the author of the book Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. We've already talked about maggots. We will get to diarrhea for sure. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 with your observations or questions for our guest. 800-838-3760 by phone or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We get into vehicles now, and protection is really tough with these, as you point out. Explain, Mary, what a shaped charge is.
Yeah, a shaped charge on an RPG, rocket-propelled grenade, is an example that a lot of people are familiar with. And that's kind of an explosive double whammy where it's one explosion to launch it at the target, and then when it makes contact, when it impacts, then it launches a second. There's another explosion that goes off and fires it shapes a piece of metal that is right in front of the explosive, and it that comes out as this sort of hot slug which penetrates quite a thick piece of metal. So, or whatever it hits. So that's what a shaped charge is. And there are much bigger and meaner iterations of shaped charges these days. But the RPG is, the one that most people hear about.
Did you get a sense from the vehicle designers just how difficult it is to try to stay ahead of the constant improvisation of weapons, particularly in the Middle East?
Yes, exactly. I mean, you come to, a country comes to war with the vehicles that it had from the last conflict. We had Humvees. Humvees were okay with rifle fire, but not with an RPG. So there was this mad scramble to up armor, as they say, to reinforce them. You can only reinforce them so much, though, before you start to have strain on the engine and the brakes because they've become so heavy. So at a certain point, better to, you know, to go with a whole new vehicle. And there's a lot of things, you know, there are new vehicles now, Strikers and MRAPs, which are mine-resistant, armored-protected personnel carriers. Those are, they have a, instead of a, because after RPGs, they began being, you know, IEDs, buried explosives, first on the roadside, and then when the sides of the vehicles were armored, they started, the insurgents started burying them in the roadway. And then they have this energy coming right up from below, slamming into the bottom, the flat bottom of the vehicle, which to which the seats were bolted. So now the feet get slammed, the pelvis gets slammed, the, you know, back injuries. So a couple of things have been done. You can make the chassis V-shaped to deflect the blast energy out to the sides, and you can also, the seats are no longer bolted to the floor. They're on kind of pistons, sort of suspension, and they're not floating, but they're, you know, attached to the sides rather than the bottom. So it separates the passenger from the impact of that blast. So those are some of the things that have been done. But, of course, these things take time, and you don't have time when people are being killed.
Where does the R&D take place? Does it happen within the Department of Defense? Do they go out to their contractors and say, we need ideas from you? Is it a combination?
They go out to contractors, yeah. And frequently, what happens is that, you know, you get a variety of contractors all with a prototype saying, this is going to protect people better. This is what we have, and it's great. But how do you know how much protection it's going to offer? What you need is a similar to what the automotive industry has, is a crash test dummy that will tell you exactly, all right, if you put people in this vehicle and a bomb goes off underneath, here's the kind of injury you can expect. And an automotive crash test dummy doesn't do the job because it's a completely different kind of force. You know, in an automotive crash, it's a head-on impact where the body's thrown forward, you know, or it's a T-bone crash. And in neither of those cases, or anything like a bomb going off under you where you have this energy slamming up from below.
Mm-hmm.
So, the automotive dummies don't move in the same way, and they aren't designed to measure the forces in the same way. So for that reason, there's a project that I write about in the book called WIAMAN, the Warrior Injury Assessment Mannequin, and they are creating essentially a crash test dummy for underbody blast. So once they have that dummy, they can put them into these vehicles that the contractors are sending over and evaluate them and say, okay, you know, we've tested it. It looks like the injuries would be minimal in this size of blast, and, you know, this seems like the one we want to go with. But without that, it was kind of anyone's guess. You could get a vague sense of it with a crash test, automotive crash test dummy, but it wasn't enough to be able to discriminate between an everyday injury and something that's going to, you know, cripple someone or kill someone.
Now, in some of the tests that you cite in the book, they used actual cadavers, which I understand got a little heated in discussions among the command chain.
Well, the cadavers. Anytime you design a new crash test mannequin, to calibrate it, you need to use cadavers. That was used for the Hybrid 3 and any, you know, any crash test dummy that is out there now, because the dummy can only tell you how much force. It doesn't tell you, well, what does that force do to a human body? So to have the meaningful information, you have to go through a phase of getting the information from actual cadavers, and then that information is used to make the dummy meaningful. So it's a process. It's not like the cadavers are being used as an alternative to a crash test dummy. They're being used to develop the crash test dummy. And that is, there was a point in this project where someone at the Pentagon had personal ethical objections to that and tried to shut it down. Now there's a sensitive use policy. There's a long chain of approvals that are required all the way up to Congress. And the project is back underway, and that's good. As one of the bioengineers pointed out, he said one good thing about that whole mess was that the cadaver testing, as it went forward, there were a number of 2- and 3-star generals there, and he said that was he thought it was good that they were able to really step in and see firsthand what what injuries, you know, what this is doing to men and women. And so, you know, that, I think it's with, you know, and the hope, my hope would be that the same kind of care and concern about dead people could be, you know,
used on live people.
On live people, yeah.
Oh, right. We get into to hearing and earplugs, and one of the things that, you know, you're trying to protect a soldier's hearing out in the field from all the loud sounds, but when you do that too, the soldier can't hear a lot of other stuff. I mean, this has become a major issue, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. War is very loud, not just the bullets and bombs, but the transport vehicles, the helicopters and the personnel carriers are very noisy. And as you said, yeah, if you just have your hearing protection, I mean, you can protect hearing, but it requires wearing hearing protection that then makes it difficult to hear the things that you need to hear to stay alive, like somebody talking to you or yelling something to you, or a vehicle coming up behind you slowly, or somebody's, you know, charging their rifle or whatever the sound is. If you don't hear it, now, you know, you may be dead, and that's more of a concern than being deaf. So soldiers tend to. The other issue is that the noise is often unpredictable. I mean, if you're on a patrol for several hours, you don't know when things are going to go kinetic, as they say, and rifles and bombs might be going off. But you can't necessarily predict that, so you have to wear the hearing protection the entire time. And it's hot, and it's uncomfortable, and that's not going to happen.
All kinds of obstacles to trying to keep people safe in the most unsafe of environments, war. Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War is the book by Mary Roach. We'll take a short break on the exchange. When we come back, we'll continue the discussion. And it's not entirely gross all the time. There's lots of interesting things here about ways we're trying to protect human beings, again, in some of the worst of the situations on the planet. You can join this discussion. We will come back and talk more with Mary and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Mary Roach. She has written a number of best-selling books, including Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers, Spook, Science Tackles the Aftermath, Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex, and Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void. There's also Gulp, Adventures in the Alimentary Canal. Mary has a lot of fun with science. She looked into military science this time to look at the ways in which we try to protect people who fight wars, even though, obviously, in fighting wars, there's a lot of not being protected. The book is called Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. You can join our discussion on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I had a feeling once I cracked the book that you were going to pick up a gun at some point and get onto a firing range. That did happen, didn't it?
It did, yes. I was at Camp Pendleton with a bunch of military audiologists, and the topic there was hearing loss, like, as we were discussing before the break. And so there, one of the things while we were there, I think it was just sort of a perk for the audiologists to put them on the firing range and with an M16 rifle. I had never held a gun in my life, so they were putting on my protective gear, and they'd say things like, are you a left-handed or a right-handed shooter?
I don't know.
I don't know that I'm a shooter at all. And I would try to, at one point you have to put the magazine, I guess it is, of ammo in, and I thought, oh, I've seen this in the movies all the time, I can do this. And so, you know, where you slap it with the heel of your hand, and that didn't work, and the guy who was helping me said, no, other way, so the bullets are facing forward. I was a fish out of water there.
Did you fire some rounds? I mean, did you hit some targets?
I did, yes. The M16 has a scope with a little red arrow that you line up on the target, and you squeeze the trigger, and the target goes down. It's really kind of amazing and scary how easy it is. I mean, I wasn't as good as most of the people there. I was hitting the close. I mean, there were some targets that were so far away I could barely see them, and some people were hitting those targets. And, you know, there were little figures, little sort of human-shaped figures out in a field in Camp Pendleton. It's a big, wide-open field, the firing range. So, it was a strange feel. It's a strange feeling for me, you know, just because it's, you know, a firing range is, it's recreational and it's kind of fun. But on the other hand, this is an M16, you know.
Right. And there was an interesting observation, too, Mary, where you talked about the fact that they said, well, you can just hold up your hand if you want to stop, which is not something people in war get to do.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the Marine who was training us said, you know, if it's not your thing, if you're uncomfortable, just raise your hand and say, this is not for me. And I could imagine there have been people in circumstances where they'd like to have been able to just raise their hand and say, hey, this is not for me.
Yeah, no kidding.
I'm sure I would probably be one of those.
You do introduce us to some people who have been through the military and have had some damage from it. Captain Gavin White is one of the people you introduce us to. What happened to him?
He's a combat engineer. He was on a route clearance mission, as in clearing the roadway of IEDs. And there was a vehicle in front of him that had been blown up, and it fell to his group to get the vehicle out of the roadway. So he was outside the vehicle, stepped on the sensor plate for an IED, and which went off under him and blew off part of one leg and a calf on the other side. And there was some damage all the way up to his pelvic region. And I was at Walter Reed reporting on urogenital trauma, which is damage to the genitals and the excretory system. And so he was it was a urethra repair that was being done. And it's a fascinating technique. They take a piece of the inside of the cheek, which is used to moisture, and make a rectangle from there, and they roll that into a tube and put that they patch the urethra so you lose any length because the alternative would be to thread the urethra through I'm going to say this wrong perineum
yeah, sounds,
perineum
yeah, I think
perineum
yeah.
Anyway, the taint would thread it through there, but that would mean sitting down to urinate like women do, and you know that's an issue. It's not life or death, but it's definitely an issue. And so by putting in a stretch of that cheek tissue, you can have the full length. You can repair the urethra. So anyway, I was in the operating room observing that operation, which was really interesting. It's fascinating. Some of the reconstruction techniques, you know, rebuilding a penis, which wasn't being done in that case, but, you know, much more sort of comprehensive repairs and rebuilds can be done, and some of the techniques come out of the transgender world.
Right. Yeah, it was an interesting observation there, but it is fascinating stuff. I mean, if you can, you know, you got to get past a little squeamishness at first, as you clearly did a long time ago. It's pretty amazing the stuff that could, and the choice of figuring out that the cheek tissue could handle moisture, therefore the constant presence of urine, as opposed to other parts of the body that you could take skin from and it wouldn't do the same thing. Which brings up an email we just got from Marcy in Eureka, who says, I've read all of Mary's books. Thanks for probing the unseen places in science and life. Looking forward to reading Grunt.
Oh, thank you, Marcy. Thank you so much.
Truly. Let's talk about heat. I mean, because that's another issue that faces people who fight, particularly in the Middle East now, because we do tend to fight in hot places. I mean, I'm curious to know if there's any acclimation that goes on, if they go to places like Fort Benning and get put through really stressful conditions to make sure that they can survive.
Well, there is an acclimation period when you deploy overseas. My understanding is, well, at least for a while, I don't know if it's still done, but they would spend a few days. in Kuwait City. Part of that was acclimating to the heat because the body does adjust. It takes a few days, but I mean, if you spend time. You know, if you take a vacation somewhere very, very hot, you'll notice that after a few days, you're not quite so miserable, and that's your body starts to sweat earlier and more heavily. When you see someone sweating heavily, it doesn't mean they're struggling with the heat. It means actually that their body is very is efficient at coping with it, because sweat is the way we offload heat from our bodies. You know, the blood is shunted to the skin, and the sweat glands offload the clear portion of blood, plasma, it kind of gets offloaded through the sweat glands as sweat, and then that heat just vaporizes into the air. So that's how we keep our bodies in the safe temperature range. And some people do that better than others. And the military over at USIS, at the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences, they have a cook box, and they can put people in and simulate these very hot environments. They were trying to figure out, is there some biomarker, some way to identify people who don't do well in the heat, because there is this tremendous individual difference.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could identify those folks, then you know you wouldn't select them for the really intense missions midday in the heat of Afghanistan or wherever you are. And so that was the project there.
And did they find that marker?
The one thing that they were finding that did make a difference was fitness level. So you know that's. You know, fitness level helps with so many things, but that's another thing. If you're in better shape, you're more efficient at, you know, using your body's limited resources. You know, because the problem is when it's hot and you're exerting yourself, your muscles need the blood to keep going. They need the oxygen in the blood to do what they need to do. Meanwhile, your body wants to send the blood to your skin to offload the heat. So if the situation gets too extreme, then your body starts to shut down organ systems, and that's when heat stroke happens, and that can be fatal.
So in the process, I mean, with you going to the firing range at Camp Pendleton and trying to tag along with Special Forces, did you ask to go through some of the heat training? Did you put on a uniform and a pack and hike at Fort Benning, for example?
I did. I went into the cook box with a couple of Army Ranger instructors, and we weren't at Fort Benning, but we were in the cook box, which is just as hot and humid. And they have treadmills in there, and they put me on the treadmill. I mean, those guys were part of the study. I was just curious.
Mm-hmm.
I did, you know, I put the temperature probe in or up. As
oh, that's right. It's a rectal thermometer, isn't it?
Yeah. So I had the probe in, and I was on the treadmill, and it was 100-degree heat. And the researcher put a pack on me that weighed 30 pounds, which is about a third the weight that someone someone deployed on some sort of a foot patrol would be carrying. And I lasted 7 minutes before my temperature started to climb to a dangerous place. So I am certainly not fit enough, not acclimated, and not going to be the person that. Yeah, I'm too old for the Marine Corps anyway, but I would not cut it.
All right, let's move on from sweat to excrement. We kind of broached the subject earlier about diarrhea. How costly has it been in American wars?
Well, the wars in the 1800s, when I think we talked a bit earlier about the situation with the flies landing in the latrines,
mm-hmm.
and then putting pathogens into the food, which the bacteria multiply and everybody gets sick. So diarrhea and dysentery, which is an extreme form in which the pathogens invade the lining of the intestine, and then so you have actually blood because the capillaries are rupturing and you get blood in the stool. So that's the definition of dysentery. So dysentery and diarrhea killed. Anywhere from 4 to 7 times as many in back in the 1800s in military battlefields. So it was deadly. It was deadly. Nowadays, if you're on a base, the food is safe and the water is safe. But the special operations units.
Yeah, this is the really fascinating part. They seem to get it more often.
They get it twice as often, and even folks just on base are getting it. I mean, during the peak of the Iraq conflict, there was a survey on diarrhea. And 77% of people had diarrhea because they sometimes eat off the base. They'll go out to to eat on the economy, as they say. So 40% had had it bad enough to seek medical treatment, and 32% had had it bad enough that they couldn't make it to a bathroom in time. And those are people who are on base where there is food, safe water. Special operations teams are mingling with local populations. I spent some time. So they're eating what they eat, and it may not have been refrigerated, and the well water isn't treated. So they're getting hit by pretty bad gastrointestinal pain and urgency. So, and you can imagine if you were on a, you know, if you're on a mission to, you know, rescue someone or take out Osama bin Laden or whatever your Navy SEAL activity for the day is, that can be a, you can't stop for it. You just keep going. And it's, you know, it's horrible at best and dangerous at worst. I mean, it's kind of a matter of national security. You know, if you have to worry about your team having horrible diarrhea. So for that reason, there was, there's a treatment regimen that was being tested at Camp Lemonnier, which is out in Djibouti in North Africa, where a lot of counterinsurgency teams leave from. And the treatment would be a one single dose, which was, you know, would get you back in working order far more quickly than the usual 3 to 4 days. So that's what was being tested there.
You saw so much in so many different places in the collection of material for what became Grunt. Is there any one thing, Mary, that really stuck with you longer than any other?
Well, I think just, you know, as a science writer, I'm usually the geeky person in the lab or in the operating room going, whoa, cool, look at that. That's really interesting. So, you know, with this book, I was, you know, I was talking to people who'd had, you know, horrific injuries. I mean, who'd stepped on bombs or had a grenade go off on their belt or just things that are hard for me to imagine. And just having conversations with these people was just, it's very moving and troubling. And, you know, I just wished them all the best and had a great deal of respect for them and also for the people doing this, the work in the labs and in the hospitals. And, you know, they put their lives at risk too. And anyway, so just, it was, you know, it had a bit of a different feel. It's still a Mary Roach book, but it's, you know, it was emotionally a little more intense.
Yeah, the conversations with the people who've been wounded and what's important to them and their return to quote-unquote normal life is really a fairly gripping part of the book. The book is called Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. It is, in fact, a Mary Roach book, and Mary Roach was our guest on The Exchange today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you bet. My pleasure.
All right, take care.